we need courage now more than ever. And the interesting thing is we have courage in abundance. And typically it's buried inside of us and it's in a container that we've locked and we don't necessarily identify with. So courage for me is not ripping off the Band-Aid and doing something. Courage for me is simply having the courage to sit and ask very simple questions about the life you inhabit. To ask yourself, is this really where I want to live? Is this how I want to live? Is this who I want to be? Is this the conversation I really need to have or want to have? Or is there a different conversation that I'm willing to go to?
Hello and welcome to the Julian Gino podcast. On today's episode, this guest needs no introduction, but I'm still going to give him an introduction anyway. Phil McKernan is an inspirational speaker, author, and coach who helps people cut through the noise to find clarity and purpose. Known for his raw honesty, and some people say he's got an Irish wit. Not really sure about that. He challenges audiences to get real, stop chasing empty success, and build a life where success and joy go hand in hand. Welcome to the show, Mr. McKernan.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you guys having me.
Listen, we've known you for a few years, and I have to say that when I met you, I'm like, who is this guy? He's driving me nuts. He's diving into me. He's pushing these buttons. He's making me go crazy. But it was such, for me, an amazing experience. I've gotten to know you over the last few years. Can you just give the listeners an idea of what you do to drive people nuts and to help them change their lives?
I ask the questions that they don't want to ask themselves or don't know how to ask themselves. I'm the mirror that they sometimes don't want to look into because there is beauty, brilliance, and dysfunction in all of us. And we hide from all of it at the same time. You can't address one without the other. When you bury your dysfunction, you bury your beauty right next to it. And my job is to unearth that for as many people as I can before I die. And essentially, that's who I am.
So what was Julia's dysfunction? What was she burying?
I was going to go into yours.
Julia's dysfunction is very simple. It's to her right.
I'm not going to disagree with that. I am not going to disagree with that. I remember reading your book. And after I read your book, I'm looking for it somewhere. I can't find it. I remember doing the exercises and having that one last talk. And this is specifically for men out there. And me and you were talking that you want to do a men's group. And I think it's amazing. You have Brave Entrepreneur. It's really hard for men, Philip, isn't it, sometimes to become vulnerable, become emotional, to have that open up. Do you find that in men? Do you find that men have a tougher time doing that?
You know, I had a gentleman on the call just yesterday, actually. And there's kind of two things I want to say about this is that, and you're right in a way, and people say that the work you do and going to the work you do, or the idea of going to the work you do is very, very hard. And I would say, I used to say, yeah, I agree, but the hard work is worth it. I would say it differently now, maybe having some years ahead, you know, or looking back, or maybe just having some deeper reflection. I would say that, no, I'll tell you what's hard. What's hard is waking up 30, 40, 50 years from now, regretting not doing the work that you could have done and not living the life that was available to you. That's hard. That's unfortunate. And it's also one of the most selfish acts on earth. Because if you bring children into this world or you decide to walk outside your door and walk into people, move into people, be around people, you're passing on all of that to them. So I'll tell you what's hard is not doing the work, whether it's with me or somebody else. The second thing is a call I had yesterday with a gentleman. And what I find is, and I don't know why, and I don't honestly think I'm the person to answer this question, but he said, I'm not very good at opening up with people. And then he goes, but with tears rolling down his face. And he said, but I just opened up to you today more than I have with anybody. And I've done therapy for 20 years and I've done this for 5 years and this for whatever. So I find that men who are closed or guarded have an intuition when they come across me that they feel either drawn to me or they don't. And if they're not drawn to me, maybe it's my personality, maybe it's my bad sense of humor that you pointed out. Generally speaking, not that I can't be an asshole, but generally speaking, it's because they're afraid that I'll see something in them that they don't want to be seen. But the last thing I'll say in this is I've had so many men come through my work and women in the same room. And they've opened up in ways that they never imagined they would. They never felt forced to do so. It was all invitation. They'll blame me. They go, oh, you, no, I didn't. I just created the space. You wanted it and you were ready for it because you knew if you didn't do it now, you wouldn't necessarily do it in the future.
Baby, let me ask one more question before you jump in, because it's important. I know what the work is. Can you define the work to somebody? Because it sounds like you got a, you know, a shovel and you're digging a hole over here. And it's a lot harder to that. But I totally agree with you. If you don't do it, it's even harder.
Yeah, I don't know if I can define the work in a single sentence. I mean, I have the word brave that simply sits in front of pretty much everything that we do. And somebody asked me within the last couple of hours in a call, like, why is brave so important to you? And brave is important to me because, and I actually reflected on this very recently. I said to myself, is brave still as relevant today as it has been for me when I did my very first brave retreat 25 or whatever it was years ago? And my answer is no, it's actually more important to me that we need courage now more than ever. And the interesting thing is we have courage in abundance, and typically it's buried inside of us and it's in a container that we've locked and we don't necessarily identify with. So courage for me is not ripping off the Band-Aid and doing something. Courage for me is simply having the courage to sit and ask very simple questions about the life you inhabit, to ask yourself, is this really where I want to live? Is this how I want to live? Is this who I want to be? Is this the conversation I really need to have or want to have? Or is there a different conversation that I'm willing to go to? And that to me is anyone who has the capacity to stop and ask themselves very simple questions about their current existence. They are the most courageous people in the world. But we give way too much credence and credit to people who are acting. Oh, look at him and look at her. Look what they built. Look what they did. Look at what they executed on. No, no, no. Courage comes when you have simply the courage to stop and ask the questions. And that to me is what courage is all about.
Yeah. It took you three sentences. It's okay. You're a little slow, but you got it. You nailed it.
I'll get there. I'll get there eventually.
You stuck the landing.
I think some of us, we feel like we live just an ordinary life. And like you said, we compare ourselves because that's what we do, especially nowadays with social media. But we feel like we just live just a simple, ordinary life. And there's nothing ultimately, I'm not going to use the word special, but what can we do? What can we give to the world? And, you know, you talk about being out in the world and giving yourself to the world and doing all this, but we don't feel like we don't have anything to give. What would you say to someone like that?
Yeah, so, well, good luck with that story. And how's it working for you? And mm-hmm. And what would it be like to try something different? What if we just took that? I mean, this is a great example of courage. Like, that's a story that we have. And mm-hmm. we're all storytellers, but not storytellers in the most positive sense. We all have these mini stories. And I had a lady, you know, I met her for coffee at 11 a.m. yesterday morning, and she basically wants to set up this business in an area of such beauty in Ireland that she grew up as a child in a surroundings with strong women in her life, a mother who was unbelievable. Her dad passed away when she was young. And she goes, I want to create a place where we can bring corporate, you know, groups and leaders down to this part of the world. And she said, like, it'd be a startup and it's going to be hard and it's going to be this and it's going to be really slow and I'm not sure I'm qualified and everything else. And she had five or six stories built into the fabric of the very thing that she's trying to launch before she even knew it. I said, can you listen to yourself? She says, what are you talking about? I said, you've just given me four or five rapid mini stories that have, if you pull the threads in those mini stories, they've got narratives and chapters and they're binded into these beautiful books called limiting beliefs or whatever you want to, however you want to entitle them. She has all these incredible stories of how she's not good enough and how it's going to be hard and how she's not going to make as big an impact. And I even said to her, start up my ass. I said, this is not a startup. You've been doing this since you were a child. You've been around this environment. So the company is a startup. The bank account is new. But what you're doing is old. And the interesting thing is the thing she wants to do more than anybody is to facilitate the actual conversations. And she said, I said, who's going to be the facilitator? She says, let's just call him Joe. Oh, this friend of mine, Joe, is going to do it. And I went, so you're going to outsource the very thing you want to do? She said, well, I'm not qualified. I said, according to whom? And she says, you think I should do it all? I said, maybe not straight away. Have Joe, but you should be 10%. And then in time, 20, and then 30. And who knows, maybe eventually you do it equally or Joe will disappear and you'll do it on your own. So if you want to hold on to a story that you're insignificant, ordinary, because that's essentially what I'm hearing, great. Good luck with that. But let me talk to the person who has just even the door slightly ajar, who's open to the possibility that their story might be different. because I can help them see how beautiful and brilliant they are. They can go out and make a bigger difference in the world. And we need more of those people doing that in the world today, more than
ever. Right behind you, you've got the book. I've been looking all over the place. One last talk. You have a quote from the book. Why does your truth matter? And how can you begin to speak it? I guess that's just piggybacking off what Julia said and what you said. Can you answer that? Because I think that's so important. How can this lady speak it? I mean, because at a visceral level, Phil, she still doesn't think that she deserves it. How can you get out of that? Whether you want to call it a limiting belief, if you believe it to be true and you don't believe that you deserve to be the Joe, and you do, it's going to be hard to get that. So how do we, I guess, start to have the person at least dwell upon that and know that they actually do believe it?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question. I have a saying that I think is at the core of what holds most human beings back. And the saying is, or the quote is, we give ourselves what we feel we deserve. And let me just qualify that just very slightly, if I may, before I come back to the original question. And like to contextualize that, how I would describe that is we can have a vision board on our wall, and it can lie at the end of our bed right on this wall of all the things that we want and that we think we deserve and we say we deserve and the say that we can manifest in the world. But every morning when you wake up and you pull back the duvet and you swing your legs around and you land on that cold tiles, that hard floor, that soft, fluffy carpet or whatever it happens to be, or get into your Mickey Mouse slippers, Gino, as I know you do every day, and we step out into the world, we're seeking to validate how we feel about ourselves. So we say intellectually we want this, but emotionally we go out and we often do the opposite. And then we refer to that as self-sabotage in some form or another. Mm-hmm. Okay. So how do you get somebody? Let's just make up a name. So Betty in Yellowknife. I always refer to Betty in Yellowknife, and I'm not sure there's a Betty who lives in Yellowknife. But I'm imagining this woman who's 50 years old, and Betty lives in a little cottage on her own or a little condo on her own. And she doesn't do a lot. You know, she goes to the shop, she volunteers locally, but she doesn't do a lot in her own mind, but she probably does more than she imagines. And Betty has a story. She's got some sort of trauma, some sort of hurt, some sort of pain that she has never really readdressed. She's never opened that can of worms again because she doesn't see any value or any point in it. And let's just say she picks up a book called One Last Talk, or she decides not to read the book, but she decides to share her story with somebody one day, a young woman who is basically 20 or 30 years younger than her. And she shares the story of her being physically, mentally, emotionally, or sexually abused in some form or another. And if you can think about those categories, most of us in some capacity have that has happened to us somewhere along the line. And she shares that story. And this young woman goes, oh my God, that happened to me. That's happening to me. Thank you for sharing your story and giving me your insight. And then Betty looks at her and goes, I didn't realize my story mattered. And then Betty goes, she has no choice, because now what we've done is we've taken the reality of the story that she's been telling herself and we've burnt it. Because now Betty has no choice but to realize if her story matters, then maybe she matters. And if she matters, then maybe her story has legs and has an opportunity to impact the world. The reason that most people stay in a space of a lack of deserving is because they make it all about them. But if you've got a story and all of us have it, our job is to take that story, to take that pain, take that discomfort and bring it to somebody to help them heal. And that's when we finally can let go of the things that hold us back. That's my experience.
We give ourselves what we feel we deserve. That explains why Julia married me. Mm. An amazing, loving person, right?
That's fine. Is that right, I mean, baby? That's all you can say.
Like,
I'm speechless.
Yeah. I usually are speechless. But if you think about it, that is really profound. And I can go back in my life and see some of the things that if I wasn't deserving of them, I wouldn't reach out. I wouldn't do the extra work. Right. I wouldn't put in the work. I would say, you know what? I don't really know if I can do it. And it's back to the story of the lady you were talking about. She doesn't feel as if she deserves to get up there and share the story and be the Joe. So she doesn't think that she deserves that. Is she going to put the extra effort in? Is she going to really go for it?
Well, it's the work, though. You know, we've done a lot of work with you, Philip, over the years.
Torturous, painful.
Some of it's really hard.
hard work.
But there's a whole... It was so worth it to the point I think back, even our first retreat that we went on, I was so uncomfortable.
It was not a vacation. I'm not going to lie to you.
I mean, we were in Ireland.
You know, beautiful cottages. It's just incredible.
The work was so difficult. And I resisted. My husband resisted more than I did. I think it took you two retreats, really.
I'm still working on it,
it's
baby.
Fine. Yeah, we're going. We got to go again. And I just want to put this out there that it's that resistance. I think every time I feel that resistance, and I think probably you taught me this, is when you feel the resistance, you got to lean into it. You got to lean into it. And it's okay to be uncomfortable. Touch upon that a little bit. It's that uncomfortableness that all of a sudden we're like, nope, I'm going to go back. And that's what I've did. I did that my whole life. Every time I was in an uncomfortable situation, I would back off. I would back up and I wouldn't share. I wouldn't talk about it. I wouldn't go there. And I think you were the one that actually ultimately taught me that it was okay to be there. You gave the space to be okay with it, to be uncomfortable. It was okay that I was feeling uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why there's so many results when it comes to your work, is that you allow it to be okay to be there and you tell the person it's okay. So talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's a big one in many ways. And I'll tell you, what I feel intuitively drawn how to answer this question is through the lens of maybe an unexpected way. And what I would encourage people to consider is, what would you want for your kids in the same situation? And a quick example, I'm in Vegas, I'm on stage, there's 500 people in the room, and I was talking about work and the work that we do in the world. And you guys are a living, breathing example of this, of having the courage to align to work that is meaningful to both of you. And I think that, all joking aside, you know, we make fun of each other, particularly Gino and myself, and it's a kind of a male thing and everything else. But, you know, what you have done with your family is extraordinary. But I think one of the things I'm imagining your kids will look back in the future and they will go, my parents had the courage and the guts to go after work that actually was enjoyable to them and that had impact and meaning in the world. And I think there's no greater gift you can give your kids. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by this, because I think the example is really important. I'm in Vegas and talking about the importance of doing work at some point in your life. It doesn't have to be tomorrow morning. That lights you up and aligns to the essence of who you are. Because here's what happens if you don't. If you don't, you bring that home to your family. If you don't, you bring that home to your wife or your husband or your partner. And you put an expectation on them to fill the hole or the gap in your heart that they simply cannot do. No matter how magnificent and how beautiful and how perfect they are, they can never fill that hole in your heart because they're human. And that we burden them and we basically take on this selfish act of doing work that's meaningless. And we expect them to fill the gap. And I'm talking about this less graphically as I just did, but I'm talking about this. And this guy pretended he was asking a question. I get this sometimes in audiences, but essentially it was a form of attack. And he put his hand up, 500 people, a mic runner goes to him and he goes, yeah, this whole living your passion, like you'd see how dismissive he was.
Yeah,
I get it, but it's not that simple. And I'm like, what would you do if you're in my situation? I said, well, tell me about your situation. Because I don't know what it is. He goes, well, I'm in a job and, you know, I kind of like it. I don't like it and whatever. And I said, well, clearly for me, there was not enough pain in his voice. He wasn't ready to make the change. He just wanted to argue and to be seen to do the work, but not actually do the work. You know, I asked him a couple of questions. I said, to me, it feels like the job is killing you. And he goes, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, he's made some comment. I said, how long have you been in that job? And he said, 14 years. And I said, excuse me? And he said, 14 years. And I said, sorry, I can't hear you. And I can hear him perfect. And he goes, and he gets really angry. He goes, 14 years. And I said, okay. And I said, have you got children? And he goes, yeah. I said, how many? He said, three. I said, give me the name of one of them. And he said, Sarah. And I said, what would you say if Sarah was in your situation? And before the last syllable left my mouth, he goes, he kind of sits forward. And he goes, I would tell Sarah, like, she's worth more. She's got value. She put respect herself. She should get out of that job. In fact, she should have got out 5 years ago. And the next minute he stops and he goes, shit. And the whole audience is kind of not laughing. They're almost in awe of what they're witnessing. This.
Yes.
Terrible fight that he's having with himself. Like he's just battling with himself and he thinks he's battling with me, but he's not. He's just fighting himself. I'm just sitting back outside the ring watching this shit show go on. And I just looked at him with as much compassion as I could muster and I just said, but here's the challenge and here's the opportunity. When Sarah gets to your age and finds herself in a predicament where she is out of alignment, feels disrespected, feels like she's not honoring herself, will she, A, come to you for advice? Maybe, maybe not, because internally she'd go, well, dad didn't do it. And we all pay the price for a grumpy dad coming home every fucking day. Excuse my language. Two, I'll go to you. You'll give me the advice to leave. But in my mind, I'll roll my eyes at him and go, yeah, Dad, I get it. But you didn't do it yourself. Or three, she comes to you or she doesn't come to you because she doesn't need to come to you. Because she grew up with a courageous father who had the courage and the guts to leave a shitty job that was killing him and do anything other than that. And she grew up watching and witnessing that as her university. And she walks out, and when Dad goes, why'd you give up your great job? Because, Dad, I watched you do it when I was 13 or 14. And you always taught me, not by what you said, but what you did, put a value on yourself. Mm-hmm. And the tears just poured down his face. What he did or didn't do, I don't know.
Let that sit for just a second, because I was going to ask this question, but it's such a beautiful segue into it. Because when we were at our first retreat, I love the question you always ask. On a scale of 1 to 10, where do you find yourself with anger? And it's mind-boggling to me. Like, everyone says 2, 3, maybe a 4. And I was part of that crew. And I remember you asking me that. And then we were in Ireland and I'm having pizza right behind the pub there. There's a nice cow in the pasture in the meadow. And you come up to me and I'm like, oh, crap, he's going to ask me a question. Well, what's he going to ask me? And we start talking and it was the anger. And I'm like, I'm not angry. I'm not an angry person. I may not be an angry person, but I do exhibit anger. And that anger was suppressed. And I had sort of the same situation where you asked me a couple of questions about my family, about my leaving New York, my brother, my mom. And that anger came out and it just came out in tears. What is it with anger? Why do people, including myself, say that we're not angry people, but yet we harbor so much anger and it can be such a destructive, I guess, emotion?
Yeah, I think it's destructive when it goes unnoticed. And I have never met a human being that's not angry. And it's something we don't identify with for various reasons. We don't want. And again, think about it in societal terms. You know, we don't have anywhere we can go and feel safe about being angry. I mean, most people get angry. There's a lot of shame around it. We also don't understand anger. Anger is a very natural thing to experience, to hold. And we have a lot of shame, and we're kind of told or not told, or it's suggested that you should never express anger. And we think anger is throwing a chair, smashing a window. It could be those things, but it also can be just really subtle. And also, we can hold a lot of physical weight in our body. Like, I know a lot of clients who have left our work and lost weight, and they go, but I didn't change anything. And they just let go of emotions. But anger is one. Sadness is another. One of the big tragedies in the world today is that we just don't want to feel. We just don't want to feel. There's a very old TV show, which I'm sure you guys are desperately familiar with because it's all over the United States, called Star Trek. Whether you watch it or have ever watched it, I don't know.
I had to watch it. I had a brother. Yeah.
And years ago, I used to watch it as a kid. And there's a race, if you want to call it, called the Borg. These people are half people. They're half machine, half. So what they do is they kidnap humans, essentially, in this steel box. They fly around the universe and they kidnap humans, and they basically take out the parts of the humans that allow the humans to feel and to think freely and so on. And they replace it with machines. So they're half human, half machine. And that's what we're becoming. And we don't want to feel. We don't want to feel the spectrum of emotion.
Well,
we're taught.
But why?
We're taught as parents. I mean, think about, you grow up and your mom yells, or I yell at the kids, stop crying. Stop yelling at your brother. And we dismiss it because most of the time as parents, we don't know what to do. And it just, right? Is that it comes from when we're younger.
That's a huge part of it, for sure. I remember, and I think about it, and I close my eyes and I could feel into the guilt and the shame I have about telling my daughter to stop crying, because what she was crying about, I didn't feel, I was the judge and jury. I didn't feel it was relevant. Right. I didn't think it was significant enough. Mm-hmm. And what I was doing is shutting down her emotion. And somebody on a call yesterday said, you know, I got a phone call from my kids. He's separated and they were bitching about his ex-wife. And he goes, I didn't really want to hear it. And somebody pointed out and said, God, isn't it wonderful that they feel safe with you to be able to do that? And he just went, what? I didn't see it like that. Mm. Isn't it just amazing they feel safe? So we're taught from a very early age that expressing emotion is bad. You get angry in school, you get given out to, and you get detention, or you get stuck in a corner, or whatever it happens to be. And it continues for a very long time. And all of us have anger. All of us have sadness. All of us have immense joy. We want to access the joy all the time, but none of us want to experience the sadness. And I let people come to me and they go, yeah. And I said, I feel a little bit of energy from you with this sadness, regret, remorse. What is it? And they go, oh, no, I used to be sad about my mother's passing, but I wrote a letter. I used to be angry with my dad, but I wrote a letter of forgiveness. And it's just poof, it's gone. And I go, well, it's just gone like that. Wow, that's amazing. It must be one hell of a letter. And then I asked them a couple of really soft, gentle questions, and suddenly they want to smash my head in because the anger just comes back. It's not gone. It's not gone. These core emotions don't disappear. What happens is we can shine a light at them. We can take the edges off. We can reduce them. And then what we can do is we can start to journey with them and live with these emotions that we don't, we have a dance with, that we've become uncomfortable. How do you journey with them? And then they become less prevalent and less controlling in terms of how we show up in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes we just want to fix. We want to fix our kids. We want to fix our husband.
Good luck
we want to fix
that.
Ourselves. And yeah. We want, no, really. We like, you know, it's almost like, let's have a conversation.
I'm the only
one
that's broken.
On.
Is that what you're saying? Yes, I'm the only one that needs work. I got it. Okay. I feel you, baby. Well, that's why we do the podcast.
Men are notorious for trying to fix situations with their partners.
Completely.
They're notorious. And I said to a group of entrepreneurs recently, I said, how many of you in the last like month or 2 months have listened to your partner, your wife or your girlfriend, and within 10 minutes, you may not have even waited the conversation finished. And even in your head, you get on your phone and you're texting them a 5-step system to fix whatever you saw on them. And they're going, shit, I did that. And then I go, and let me tell you, they got pissed off in one way or the other way. They were passively or frustrated or verbally frustrated with you. Yeah. And then you justified it by going, but honey, I just want you to be happy. And they were going, oh my God, were you in the room? And they go, you mean that's not the right? I said, no, it's not the right thing to do. It's no right or wrong, but there's a much better way. And it was hilarious.
That's one of the, I think there's, I mean, obviously there's many things that you learn along your journey of marriage and parenthood. And I think one of them is you can't fix the other person. And sometimes it's painful to just sit and listen and to say, listen, are you looking for help or do you just want to talk? Because I'm here if you want it. That's a really hard, it took me many, many, many years to figure that out. Same with you. And it's almost a joke now because I'll go to him with a problem. And he's like, all right, let's go. Look, I got this online, just like you said, Philip. I'm like, no, that's not what it is.
Part of it is that's how I was raised. Going back to the childhood, we had to fix things. And that's part of my psychology, my makeup. I like to build things. I like to solve problems. And that's part of the issue. Now that I know that, I can understand.
But
that.
Like Philip's saying too, Philip, it's a lot of times, even with the kids, they're sad, they're angry, they're upset about something that you can't solve it. And so it's very hard as a parent, especially when you're just figuring this out, that you just have to sit there and listen and not, there's nothing, sometimes there's nothing you can actually physically do to make the situation better. And we dealt that with all our children. I'm a very different parent than I used to be. That's for sure. A lot of it in the past few years and a lot of apologies with them. And because, you know, I was and I could speak for myself, is that I would say, here's what we're going to do. Here's how you're going to feel. All of those things. And, you know, of course, I messed up my kids plenty, but there was a lot of conversation that came out of it. And so I want to tell people that it's not too late to have those conversations, even if you have adult children and you realize that, wow, I was very, very, I handled a lot of things the wrong way. Pick up the phone and have a conversation. It is never too late to talk to your children about that.
Yeah, I had a funny quick one, you know, if you don't mind, I had an interesting one with Maggie, our daughter, who's a real firecracker. And it's always, not always, but often about technology. And we have our own views on technology. And in many ways, I wish they didn't have a single piece of technology, even within proximity. However, for whatever reason, right or wrong, they both got phones at a certain age, et cetera. They're limited in terms of timing, which drives them nuts. And inevitably, every so often, although it hasn't happened in a long time, but one day it escalated and Maggie was getting really angry and frustrated. And I would normally jump in and go, Maggie, but listen, it's not good for you. And, you know, here's a link in Google that is to a TED talk that says where your brain is melting and it's going to be like M's and Smarties, we're not careful and whatever. And she has no interest in that stuff. And then one day she's getting really, really, really mad. And I'm not saying a lot. And she's getting even more mad. And I said, Maggie, if you were me, if you were the parent and I was you, What would you do? And she just goes, that is so annoying. And I said, why? Because she says, I do exactly what you're doing, Dad. And you know that's what I was going to say. But that doesn't help the situation. And it was, and then she was getting mad. And I'm trying not to laugh. And I'm starting to smile. And she burst into laughter and tears at the same time. And it just diffused everything. But up to that point, it was like, but Maggie, here's the research and it's not going to work and whatever. And she had no, and she doesn't care less about the research. She doesn't give a shit. As I find with people, if I could promise them long, that's why I think the longevity conversation doesn't really work for most people. I can show people how to live 10 years longer. I actually don't want to do that anyway. I want them to live with quality over the next 10 years, not live 10 years late. But people don't move the needle for an extra couple of years. Even with all the research in the world, they just don't.
As we're wrapping up the show, I need to ask this question. I've got so many more questions, but this one is important because we wrote a book called Happy Money, Happy Family, Happy Legacy. And I think people, when they hear the legacy, they're always about the financial component and how much am I going to leave money to my kids. And I know that is the farthest thing from your mind. And I think you hold family as important as Julia and myself. If your kids are listening to this years from now, what do you hope that they'll remember about your message? What do you want to convey to them as part of legacy?
I think the thing that I would want to hear, or I would wish that my kids would say, is that he was the same pain in the ass on the podcast as he is at the retreats and that he is at home. And I think that that sense of showing up in an authentic way as best I can, I would want that to run and to permeate through the whole thing. And the last thing is that he was kind. He was a kind person under it all, despite getting frustrated, losing his head, getting angry, getting pissed off, being judgmental, whatever, that ultimately he was a kind human being. And that is something that we have taken from him.
That's awesome.
Well, you're super authentic and real, Philip. So I always appreciated that. I think that's what's missing in the world a lot of right now. I really do. I think sometimes people say what others want to hear. And I think you give the space, but you also say what is needed and what is true. So I really do appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you.
And you drive me nuts.
Yes.
Because for me,
it's super fun to watch. It's so fun.
It's interesting because, and I'll leave the listeners with this. If you're in a business and you're struggling or you're looking to change careers, I several months ago exited a business and I just had to wait. And it was just so difficult. And I sort of knew the answer was, but sometimes you have to have somebody there shining the light. And Philip was there shining the light and he saw it and he's so good at seeing the obvious. So if you're out there, you're struggling, you want to make a change, you're sitting in Vegas with 500 other people and you know the answer, but it's hard and it's lonely and you don't have an amazing spouse like I do that you can go to and sit with and have a frank conversation. And sometimes even when you do, you need outside because Julie's rooting for me. She wants me to succeed. And sometimes that blurs the vision. Whereas Philip is just there shining the light and he's being raw and honest with you. And I think that's the difference. So where can the listeners find out more about you, Philip?
PhilipMcKernan.com. As simple as that.
PhilipMcKernan.com.
Yeah. So good.
We could spend the next 3 hours talking to you. I don't know if you could spend the next 3 hours talking to us. I'm not sure about that, but this is awesome. Every time I get the chance to speak to you, I just leave invigorated. I leave a little bit wiser, and it's been fun. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise, I've been looking forward to this, and it's a real, real privilege. And the two of you look absolutely fantastic. To me, when you meet people, or you meet people again, you know, I'm sure not everything's perfect. And I'm sure there's nuances and challenges and frustrations like there is in life, but your faces, there's an aliveness in your faces. And anyone who knows you and knows your work and has watched your journey, they would look at your faces and the faces and the eyes cannot lie. They just don't. So to look at both of you with microphones in front of you, doing your thing, you know, incredibly proud of both of you and a privilege to play a very small part in that journey.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Philip.
We appreciate it. And to those of you out there, I'm Gino. This is Julia, and we'll see you on the next Julie and Gino podcast. Thanks, everyone.